Richard Martin's Wake Up Call Podcast, presented every Monday and Friday, providing you with the truth and the facts. You decide.
Good day to you all, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Wake Up Call, dated this Christmas Day, the 25th of December, 2015. Yes, it's a holiday for everyone around here, Malaysia, Singapore. Even if few of the inhabitants pay much lip service to Christmas, I'm afraid there's nothing very Christmassy about what I have to say to you today. I'm going to start by talking in general terms about the state of the police state today, which I think you'll agree is pretty shocking. I go into some detail, so this will be a fairly lengthy report. Then we'll have a look at what it would have been like for Jesus if he'd been born today. You know, if you don't think you live in a police state after listening to what I have to say next, I can truly and honestly do or say nothing more to help you, and you might just as well stop listening to the Wake Up Call from here on out. Otherwise, be prepared to be profoundly shocked at the following information. I'm going to tell you how police forces are openly taking the position that they are not accountable to democratic processes, and how that attitude is translating into policies and actions. You are already likely to know about many of the developments cited here: militarization, heated rhetoric about how anyone who challenges police operations is a threat to public safety, open confrontations with elected officials. But some things are new to me, such as police in many states securing much better rights against prosecution than the rest of us. If you've been listening to various police agencies and their supporters, you know what the future holds. Anarchy is coming, and it's all the fault of agencies and their supporters. You know what the future holds? In May, a Wall Street Journal op-ed warned of a new nationwide crime wave thanks to intense agitation against American police departments over the previous year. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie went further. Talking recently with the host of CBS's Face the Nation, the Republican presidential hopeful asserted that the Black Lives Matter movement wasn't about reform, but about something far more sinister. Quote unquote, "They've been chanting in the streets for the murder of police officers." Even the nation's top cop, FBI Director James Comey, weighed in at the University of Chicago Law School, speaking of, quote-unquote, "a chill wind that has blown through American law enforcement over the last year." According to these figures and others like them, lawlessness has been sweeping the nation as the so-called Ferguson effect spreads. Criminals have been emboldened as police officers are forced to think twice about doing their jobs for fear of the infamy of starring in the next viral video. The police have supposedly become the targets of assassins intoxicated by anti-cop rhetoric, just as departments are being stripped of the kind of high-powered equipment they need to protect officers and communities. Even their funding streams have, it's claimed, come under attack as anti-cop bias has infected Washington, D.C. Senator Ted Cruz caught the spirit of that critique by convening a Senate subcommittee hearing to which he gave the title, "The War on Police: How the Federal Government Undermines State and Local Law Enforcement." According to him, the federal government, including the president and attorney general, has been vilifying the police, who are now being treated as if they, not the criminals, were the enemy. Beyond the storm of commentary and criticism, however, quite a different reality presents itself. In the simplest terms, There is no war on the police. Violent attacks against police officers remain at historic lows. Even though approximately 1,000 people have been killed by the police this year nationwide. In just the past few weeks, videos have been released of problematic fatal police shootings in San Francisco and Chicago. While it's too soon to tell whether there has been an uptick in violent crime in the post-Ferguson period, no evidence connects any possible increase to the phenomenon of police violence being exposed to the nation. What is taking place, and what the police and their supporters are largely reacting to, is a modest push for sensible law enforcement reforms from groups as diverse as Campaign Zero, Koch Industries, the Cato Institute, the Leadership Conference, and the ACLU. Unfortunately, as the rhetoric ratchets up, many police agencies and organizations are increasingly resistant to any reforms, forgetting whom they serve and ignoring constitutional limits on what they can do. Indeed, a closer look at law enforcement arguments against common sense reforms, like independently investigating police violence, demilitarizing police forces, or ending for-profit policing, reveals a striking disregard for concerns of just about any sort when it comes to brutality and abuse. What this so-called debate has revealed, in fact, is a mainstream policing mindset ready to manufacture fear without evidence and promote the belief that American civil rights and liberties are actually an impediment to public safety. In the end, such law enforcement arguments subvert the very idea that the police are there to serve the community and should be under civilian control. And that, when you come right down to it, is the logic of the police state. It's no mystery why so few police officers are investigated and prosecuted for using excessive force and violating someone's rights. According to Campaign Zero, and I quote, "Local prosecutors rely on local police departments to gather the evidence and testimony they need to successfully prosecute criminals. This makes it hard for them to investigate and prosecute the same police officers in cases of police violence." End of quote. Since 2005, according to an analysis by the Washington Post and Bowling Green State University, only 54 officers have been prosecuted nationwide, despite the thousands of police fatal shootings. As Philip M. Stinson, a criminologist at Bowling Green, puts it, and I quote, "To charge an officer in a fatal shooting, it takes something so egregious, so over the top, that it cannot be explained in any rational way. It also has to be a case that prosecutors are willing to hang their reputation on." End of quote. For many in law enforcement, however, none of this should concern any of us. When New York Governor Andrew Cuomo signed an executive order appointing a special prosecutor to investigate police killings, for instance, Patrick Lynch, president of the Patrolmen's Benevolent Association, insisted, and I quote, "Given the many levels of oversight that already exist, both internally in the NYPD and externally in many forms, the appointment of a special prosecutor is unnecessary," end of quote. Even before Cuomo's decision, the chairman of New York's District Attorneys Association called plans to appoint a special prosecutor for police killings deeply insulting. Such pushback against the very idea of independently investigating police actions has, post-Ferguson, become everyday fare. And some law enforcement leaders have staked out a position significantly beyond that. The police, they clearly believe, should get special treatment. Quote, "By virtue of our dangerous vocation, we should expect to receive the benefit of doubt in controversial incidents." End of quote. And that's Ed Mullins writing, the president of New York City's Sergeants Benevolent Association, in the organization's magazine Frontline. As if to drive home the point, its cover depicts Baltimore State Attorney Marilyn Mosby under the ominous headline, "The Wolf That Lurks." In May, Mosby had announced indictments of 6 officers in the case of Freddie Gray, who died in Baltimore police custody the previous month. The message being sent to a prosecutor willing to indict cops was hardly subtle. "You're a traitor." Mullins put forward a legal standard for officers accused of wrongdoing that he would never support for the average citizen, and in a situation in which cops already get what the former federal prosecutor Laurie Levinson calls a super presumption of innocence. In addition, police unions in many states have aggressively pushed for their own Bill of Rights, which make it nearly impossible for police officers to be fired, much less charged with crimes when they violate an individual's civil rights and liberties. In 14 states, versions of a Law Enforcement Officer's Bill of Rights have already been passed, while in 11 others, they are under consideration. These provide an extra layer of due process in cases of alleged police misconduct. According to Samuel Walker, an expert on police accountability, in many of the states without a law enforcer's officer's Bill of Rights, the Marshall Project has discovered police unions have directly negotiated the same rights and privileges with state governments. Law enforcement officers' Bill of Rights are, in effect, amazingly un-American documents in the protections they afford officers accused of misconduct during internal investigations, rights that those officers are never required to extend to their suspects. Though the specific language of these laws varies from state to state, notes Mike Riggs in Reason, they are remarkably similar in their special considerations for the police, and I quote, "Unlike a member of the public, the officer gets a cooling-off period before he has to respond to any questions. Unlike a member of the public, the officer under investigation is privy to the names of his complainants and their testimony against him before he is ever interrogated. Unlike a member of the public, the officer under investigation is to be interrogated, quote unquote, at a reasonable hour, with a union member present. Unlike a member of the public, the officer could only be questioned by one person during his interrogation. Unlike a member of the public, the officer can be interrogated only, quote unquote, for reasonable periods, which, quote unquote, shall be timed to allow for such personal necessities and rest periods as are reasonably necessary. Unlike a member of the public, the officer under investigation cannot be, quote unquote, threatened with disciplinary action at any point during his interrogation. If he is threatened with punishment, whatever he says following the threat cannot be used against him." End of quote. The Marshall Project refers to these laws as the Blue Shield, and the original Bill of Rights with an upgrade. Police associations naturally don't agree. According to Vince Canales, the president of Maryland's Fraternal Order of Police, and I quote, "All this does is provide a very basic level of constitutional protections for our officers so that they can make statements which will stand up in court." End of quote. Put another way, there are two kinds of due process in America, one for cops and another for the rest of us. This is the reason why the Black Lives Matter movement and other civil rights and civil liberties organizations regularly call on states to create a special prosecutor's office to launch independent investigations when police seriously injure or kill someone. Since Americans first took in those images from Ferguson of police units outfitted like soldiers, riding in military vehicles and pointing assault rifles at protesters, the militarization of the police and the way the Pentagon has been supplying them with equipment directly off the country's distant battlefields have been top concerns for police reformers. In May, the Obama administration suggested modest changes to the Pentagon's 1033 program, which, since 1990, has been redistributing weaponry and equipment to police departments nationwide, urban, suburban, and rural, in the name of fighting the war on drugs and protecting Americans from terrorism. Even the idea that the police shouldn't sport the look of an occupying army in local communities has, however, been met with fierce resistance. Read, for example, the online petition started by the National Sheriffs Association, and you could be excused for thinking that the Obama administration was aggressively moving to stop the flow of military-grade equipment to local and state police agencies. It isn't. The message that tops the petition is as simple as it is misleading, quote unquote. Don't strip law enforcement of the gear they need to keep us safe. The Obama administration has done no such thing. In May, the president announced that he was prohibiting certain military-grade equipment from being transferred to state and local law enforcement. Quote, "Some equipment made for the battlefield is not appropriate for local police departments," unquote. And that was Obama speaking. The list including tracked armored vehicles, essentially tanks, bayonets, grenade launchers, camouflage uniforms, and guns and ammo of 50 caliber or higher. In reality, what use could a local police department have for bayonets, grenade launchers, or the kinds of bullets that resemble small missiles, pierce armor, and can blow people's limbs off? Yet the Sheriff's Association has no problem complaining that, quote-unquote, the White House announced the government would no longer provide equipment like helicopters and MRAPs, that's mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicles, to local law enforcement. End of quote. And it's not even true. Police departments can still obtain both helicopters and MRAPs if they establish community policing practices, institute training protocols, and get community approval before the equipment transfer occurs. The Sheriff's Association adds gravely, and I quote, "Helicopters, rescue runways, and natural disaster victims and MRAPs are used to respond to shooters who barricade themselves in neighborhoods and are one of the few vehicles able to navigate hurricane, snowstorm, and tornado-strewn areas to save survivors." End of quote. As with America's wars abroad, think Mission Creep at home. a program started to wage the war on drugs and strengthened after 9/11, is now being justified on the grounds that certain equipment is useful during disasters or emergencies. In reality, the police have clearly become hooked on a militarized look. Many departments are ever more attached to their weapons of war, and evidently don't mind the appearance of being an occupying force in their communities, which leaves groups like the Sheriff's Association fighting fiercely for a militarized future. In July, the American Civil Liberties Union and the ACLU of Arizona sued law enforcement in Pinal County, Arizona, on behalf of Rhonda Cox. 2 years before, her son had stolen some trucker accessories and, without her knowledge, fitted them on her truck. When the county sheriff's department arrested him, it also seized the truck. Arriving on the scene of her son's arrest, Cox asked a deputy about getting her truck back. "No way," he told her. After she protested, explaining that she had nothing to do with her son's alleged crimes, he responded, "Too bad." Under Arizona law, the truck could indeed be taken into custody and kept or sold off by the sheriff's department, even though she was never charged with a crime. It was guilty, even if she wasn't. Welcome to America's civil asset forfeiture laws. Another product of law enforcement's failed war on drugs, updated for the 21st century. Originally designed to deprive suspected real-life scarfaces of the spoils of their illicit trade, houses, cars, boats, it now regularly deprives people unconnected to the war on drugs of their property without due process of law and in violation of the 5th and 14th Amendments. Not surprisingly, corruption follows. Federal and state law enforcement can now often keep property seized or sell it and retain a portion of the revenue generated. Some of this, in turn, can be repurposed and distributed as bonuses in police and other law enforcement departments. The only way the dispossessed stand a chance of getting such forfeited property back is if they are willing to take on the government in a process where the deck is stacked against them. In such cases, for instance, property owners have no right to an attorney to defend them, which means that they must either pony up additional cash for a lawyer or contest the seizure themselves in court. According to the Libertarian Institute for Justice, and I quote, "It is an upside-down world where the government holds all the cards and has the financial incentive to play them to the hilt." End of quote. In this century, civil asset forfeiture has mutated into what's now called for-profit policing, in which police departments and state and federal law enforcement agencies indiscriminately seize the property of citizens who aren't drug kingpins. Sometimes, for instance, distinctly ordinary citizens suspected of drunk driving or soliciting prostitutes get their cars confiscated. Sometimes they simply get cash taken from them on suspicion of low-level drug dealing. Like most criminal justice issues, race matters in civil asset forfeiture. This summer, the ACLU of Pennsylvania issued a report, Guilty Property, documenting how the Philadelphia Police Department and the District Attorney's Office abused state civil asset forfeiture by taking at least $1 million from innocent people within the city limits. Approximately 70% of the time, those people were black, even though the city's population is almost evenly divided between whites and African Americans. Currently, only one state, New Mexico, has done away with civil asset forfeiture entirely, while also severely restricting state and local law enforcement from profiting off similar national laws when they work with the feds. The police in Albuquerque are, however, actively defying the new law, demonstrating yet again the way in which police departments believe the rules don't apply to them. The fact that no other state has done so is hardly surprising. Police departments have become so reliant on civil asset forfeiture to pad their budgets and acquire little goodies that reforming, much less repealing, such laws are a tough sell. As with militarization, when police defend such policies, you sense their urgent desire to maintain what many of them now clearly think of as police rights. In August, for instance, Pinal County Sheriff Paul Baboy sent a fundraising email to his supporters using the imagined peril of the ACLU lawsuit as clickbait. In justifying civil forfeiture, he failed to mention that a huge portion of the money goes to enrich his own department, but praised the program in this fashion, and I quote, "Over the past 7 years, the Pinal County Sheriff's Office has donated $1.2 million of seized criminal money to support youth programs like the Boys and Girls Clubs, Boy Scouts, YMCA, high school graduation, night lock-in events, youth supports, as well as veterans groups, local food banks, victims assistance programs, and Home of Home in Casa Grande." End of quote. Under this logic, police officers can steal from people who haven't even been charged with a crime, as long as they share the wealth with community organizations, though in fact, neither in Pinal County or elsewhere is that where most of the confiscated loot appears to go. Think of this as the development of a culture of thievery masquerading as Robin Hood in blue. Post-Ferguson developments in policing are essentially a struggle over whether the police deserve special treatment and exceptions from the rules the rest of us must follow. For too long, they have avoided accountability for brutal misconduct, while in this century, arming themselves for war on America's streets and misusing laws to profit off the public trust, largely in secret. The events of the past 2 years have offered graphic evidence that police culture is dysfunctional and in need of a democratic reformation. There are, of course, still examples of law enforcement leaders who see the police as part of American society, not exempt from it. But even then, the reformers face stiff resistance from the law enforcement communities they lead. In Minneapolis, for instance, Police Chief Janae Harto attempted to have state investigators look into incidents when her officers seriously hurt or kill someone in the line of duty. Police union opposition killed her plan. In Philadelphia, Police Commissioner Charles Ramsey ordered his department to release publicly the names of officers involving in shootings within 72 hours of any incident. The city's police union promptly challenged this policy, while the Pennsylvania House of Representatives passed a bill in November to stop the release of the names of officers who fire their weapon or use force when on the job, unless criminal charges are filed. Not surprisingly, three powerful unions in the state supported the legislation. In the present atmosphere, many in the law enforcement community see the Hartos and Ramses of their profession as figures who don't speak for them, and groups or individuals wanting even the most modest of police reforms as so many police haters. As former New York Police Department Commissioner Howard Safir told Fox News in May, and I quote, "Similar to athletes on the playing field, Sometimes it's difficult to tune out the booze from the no-talents sipping their drinks, sitting comfortably in their seats. It's demoralising to read about the misguided anti-cop gibberish spewing from those who take their freedoms for granted. End of quote. The disdain in such imagery, increasingly common in the world of policing, is striking. It smacks of a police state bunker mentality that sees democratic values and just about any limits on the power of law enforcement as threats. In other words, the Saffirs want the public, particularly in communities of colour and poor neighbourhoods, to shut up and do as it's told when a police officer says no. If the cops give the orders, compliance, so this line of thinking goes, isn't optional, no matter how egregious the misconduct or how sensible the reforms. Obey or else. The post-Ferguson public clamour demanding better policing continues to get louder, and yet too many police departments have this to say in response. Welcome to Copland. We make the rules around here.
Share the truth. Invite others to listen to Richard Martin's wake-up call. Richard Martin produces his shows single-handedly, based on his extensive reading and research. Every week, Richard gives you the facts with no spin, for you to make informed decisions on world events that will affect your life. Now, let's get back to today's show.
Okay, the Christmas narrative of a baby born in a manger is a familiar one. The Roman Empire, a police state in its own right, had ordered that a census be conducted. Joseph and his pregnant wife Mary travelled to the little town of Bethlehem so that they could be counted. There being no room for the couple at any of the inns, they stayed in a stable where Mary gave birth to a baby boy. That boy, Jesus, would grow up to undermine the political and religious establishment of his day and was eventually crucified as a warning to others not to challenge the powers that be. But what if Jesus, the revered preacher, teacher, radical, and prophet, had been born 2,000 years later? How would Jesus' life have been different had he been born and raised, for example, in the American police state? Had Jesus been born in the year 2015? Rather than travelling to Bethlehem for a census, Jesus' parents would have been mailed a 28-page American community survey, a mandatory government questionnaire documenting their habits, household inhabitants, work schedule, and even how many toilets were in their home, etc. The penalty for not responding to this invasive survey would have resulted in a fine of $5,000. Instead of being born in a manger, Jesus might have been born at home. Rather than wise men and shepherds bringing gifts, however, the baby's parents might have been forced to ward off visits from state social workers intent on prosecuting them for the home birth. One couple in Washington had all three of their children removed after social services objected to the two youngest being birthed in an unassisted home delivery. Had Jesus been born in a hospital, his blood and DNA would have been taken and entered into a government biobank without his parents' knowledge or consent. While most states require newborn screening, a growing number are indefinitely holding onto that genetic material long-term for research, analysis, and purposes yet to be disclosed. Then again, had his parents been undocumented immigrants, they and the newborn baby might have been shuffled to a profit-driven private detention centre for illegals. There's quite a lot of money to be made from imprisoning immigrants, especially when taxpayers are footing the bill. Once in school, Jesus would have been drilled in lessons of compliance and obedience to government authorities, all the while learning little about his own rights. And if he dared to challenge school officials, he might have found himself suspended under a school zero-tolerance policy that punishes minor infractions, such as doodling or talking in class, as harshly as more serious offences, such as bringing a weapon to class. According to Scripture, Jesus, at the age of 12, wandered the temple courts in Jerusalem alone and unsupervised. Today, had Jesus disappeared for a few hours, let alone days, his parents would have been handcuffed, arrested, and jailed for parental negligence. Parents across the country have been arrested for far less offences, such as allowing their children to walk to the park unaccompanied and play in their front yard alone. Rather than disappearing from the history books from his early teenage years to adulthood, Jesus' movements and personal data, including his biometrics, would have been documented, tracked, monitored and filed by governmental agencies and corporations such as Google and Microsoft. Incredibly, 95% of school districts share their student records with outside companies contracted to manage the data. If Jesus were ever to make contact with the likes of John the Baptist, he would have been flagged for surveillance because of his association with a prominent activist, peaceful or otherwise. Since 9/11, the FBI has actively carried out surveillance and intelligence gathering operations on a broad range of activist groups, from animal rights groups to poverty relief and anti-war organizations. Rather than being permitted to live as an itinerant preacher, Jesus might have found himself threatened with arrest for daring to live off the grid or sleeping outside. In fact, the number of cities that have resorted to criminalizing homelessness by enacting bans on camping, sleeping in vehicles, loitering, and begging in public has doubled in recent years. Had his travels taken him from community to community, Jesus might have been reported to government officials as suspicious. Under the Department of Homeland Security, See Something, Say Something programs. Many states, including New York, are providing individuals with phone apps that allow them to take photos of suspicious activity and report them to their state intelligence center, where they are reviewed and forwarded to law enforcement agencies. Perceived as a dissident and a potential threat to the government's power, Jesus might have had government spies planted among his followers in order to monitor his activities, report on his movements, and entrap him into breaking the law. Jesus's anti-government views would certainly have resulted in him being labeled a domestic extremist. Law enforcement agencies are being trained to recognize signs of anti-government extremism during interactions with potential extremists who share a belief in the approaching collapse of government and the economy. End of quote. Assuming Jesus used the internet to spread his radical message of peace and love, he might have found his blog posts infiltrated by government spies attempting to undermine his integrity, discredit him, or plant incriminating information online about him. At the very least, he would have had his website hacked and his email monitored. Had Jesus attempted to feed large crowds of people, he would have been threatened with arrest for violating various ordinances prohibiting the distribution of food without a permit. Florida officials arrested a 90-year-old man for feeding the homeless on a public beach. Had Jesus spoken publicly about his 40 days in the desert and his conversations with the devil, he might have been labelled mentally ill and detained in a psych ward against his will for a mandatory involuntary psychiatric hold with no access to family or friends. One Virginia man was arrested, strip-searched, handcuffed to a table, diagnosed of having mental health issues, and locked up for 5 days in a mental health facility against his will, apparently because of his slurred speech and unsteady gait. Without a doubt, had Jesus attempted to overturn tables in a Jewish temple and raged against the materialism of religious institutions, he would have been charged with a hate crime. Currently, 45 states and federal government have hate crime laws on the books. Rather than having armed guards capture Jesus in a public place, government officials would have ordered that a SWAT team carry out a raid on Jesus and his followers, complete with flashbang grenades and military equipment. There are more than 80,000 such SWAT team raids carried out each year, many on unsuspecting Americans who have no defense against such government invaders, even when such raids are done in error. Instead of being detained by Roman guards, Jesus might have been made to disappear into a secret government detention center where he would have been interrogated, tortured, and subjected to all manner of abuses. Chicago police disappeared more than 7,000 people into a secret, off-the-books interrogation warehouse at Homan Square. Charged with treason and labelled a domestic terrorist, Jesus might have been sentenced to a life term in a prison private cell where he would have been forced to provide slave labour for corporations or put to death by way of the electric chair or a lethal mixture of drugs. Either way, whether Jesus had been born in our modern age or his own, he still would have died at the hands of a police state. Charming, really, isn't it? Well, quoting Rand Paul, looking directly at Governor Chris Christie, who had just responded to a question from CNN's Wolf Blitzer as to whether he would shoot down a Russian plane that violated his no-fly zone in Syria, "If you're in favour of World War III, you have your candidate." And Christie responded and blurted out, "Not only would I be prepared to do it, I would do it. I would talk to Vladimir Putin. I'd say to him, listen, Mr. President, there's no fly zone in Syria. It applies to you. Yes, shoot down planes of Russian pilots. If in fact they were stupid enough to think that this president was the same Chris Wheatley we have in the Oval Office right now." End of quote. Ex-Governor George Pataki and ex-Senator Rick Santorum would also impose a no-fly zone and shoot down Russian planes that violated it. Said Governor John Kasich, and I quote, "It's time we punched the Russians in the nose," end of quote. Carly Fiorina would impose a no-fly zone and not even talk to Putin, quote unquote, "until we've conducted military exercises in the Baltic states," which of course are on Russia's border. Jeb Bush too would impose a no-fly zone. You see, these warhawks apparently assume that President Putin is a coward who, if you shoot down his warplanes, will back away from a fight. But they don't actually care. They'd spoil for a fight anyway. And then, of course, lose. What a frightening country this has become, hasn't it? All right, well, I've given you the advice you need, ladies and gentlemen. Still the same old advice. Boring, really, isn't it? Doesn't really change. British families are on course to spend £40 billion more than they earn this year, fueling fears that the country's economic growth is based on soaring levels of debt and could easily collapse. The forecast by the Independent Office for Budget Responsibility, or OBR, led to warnings that the UK could be headed towards a credit crunch similar to that of 2008 because of unsustainable levels of borrowing and household spending. Seema Malhotra, the shadow chief secretary to the Treasury, said, and I quote, "George Osborne is relying on millions of British families going further into debt to hit his growth targets. This is risky behaviour from a Chancellor whose policy decisions are hurting, not only helping British families." Alarm bells should be ringing. There is a real risk that millions of families will face serious hardship if interest rates start to rise. End of quote. The former business secretary, Sir Vince Cable, who warned in The Independent last month of the dangers of excessive household debt, said, and I quote, "We're back on the treadmill of growth being sustained by personal borrowing. Much of it is against an inflating housing stock. Taken together with other indicators, like the very weak external deficit position, it suggests we're getting back to the old and unhappily discredited forms of economic growth." End of quote. Here's another rather sad statistic. Under Obama, the US national debt has risen from $10.6 trillion on January the 20th, 2009, to over $18.8 trillion on December the 21st, 2015. That means that the debt that America is passing on to future generations has increased by $8.16 trillion since Obama was inaugurated. There's still a little more than a year to go in Obama's presidency, and it's already guaranteed that Obama will add more than $1 trillion a year to the national debt during his presidency. In fact, America's stealing more than $100 million from future generations of Americans every hour of every day. It is a crime of a magnitude that is almost unimaginable. And at this point, it is mathematically impossible for the US government to pay off all of this debt. To say that the country is in trouble would be a massive understatement. And of course, not all of the blame goes to Obama. The Republicans have had control of the House of Representatives for all but 2 years while Obama's been in the White House, and they've gone along with all this reckless spending. Without the approval by the House, Obama couldn't spend a single penny. But the Republicans have consistently chosen not to stand up to him. In fact, the Republicans in Congress just approved another massive $1.2 trillion spending bill that essentially gave the Democrats every single thing they wanted. Even House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi admitted that the Republicans were, quote-unquote, willing to concede so much during the negotiations. So now, ladies and gentlemen, I have proof for my contention that Americans are, in the main, a warmongering, bloodthirsty people. According to a report released by Public Policy Polling on Friday a week ago, almost one-third of Republican primary voters would support bombing the fictional kingdom of Agrabah. In its poll, Public Policy Polling asked the 532 Republicans, would you support or oppose bombing Agrabah? While 57% of responders say they were not sure, 30% said they supported bombing it. Only 13% opposed it. Agrabah, you may remember, was the kingdom from Disney's animated classic Aladdin. Isn't that just charming? You know it, ladies and gentlemen. And now you know I know it, and now I know you know it, so let's not pretend anymore. Americans are on the prowl for war, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And that's how it is, and that's how it's been. I gave you chapter and verse last week. This has been how it is since the 17th century. And the tradition is alive and well in the 21st. One sector that has seen a huge fall in recent weeks is the transportation sector. Many stocks are down 20 or 30% from their highs, while the rest of the market is flirting with all-time highs. Can an economy really thrive if it doesn't make or move physical things? Intuitively, the answer is no, because most services either maintain the status quo, like healthcare and restaurants, or, like houses, consume rather than build capital. As for banking, in its current incarnation, it's almost certainly a net negative, draining capital from productive uses and funneling it to trading desks and political action committees. The US is engaged in an experiment to see how long an economy can function with services growing and manufacturing contracting. As with so many of today's monetary and fiscal experiments, no one knows when definitive results will come in. But the data so far tell an unmistakably grim story of the future. Connecticut Governor Daniel Malloy plans to sign the first executive order in the nation to ban the sales of guns to people on federal government watch lists. Quote, "We intend to prevent, by executive order through my powers as governor, those on government watch lists from obtaining a permit to purchase a firearm in Connecticut." Unquote. That might pass muster if you'd been convicted of a crime, or even if you were indicted. And by the way, ladies and gentlemen, this is not a comment on whether gun control is a good or bad thing. I am just here referring to the conditions, okay? But you see, that's not how it works. If you're on a watch list, you probably don't know you're on one until you try to fly, and then you can't, after you bought the ticket, which is now forfeited. So the government first causes to lose money theft without any process of law. They put you on the watch list without due process of law. There is no formal means to challenge the same, nor any right to see the evidence against you or challenge those who offered testimony, if anyone at all. In fact, you might very well be on the list purely for political reasons. There's no way to know. Now, I'm sure some people on the list are terrorists, but that's not the point, because we know some people who clearly are not terrorists have been on the list, including the late Senator Kennedy. To remove someone's constitutional rights, you must surely first convict them of an offence, at least in theory. yet more invasive restrictions on your privacy and freedom. All I can say is that it's yet another notch on the multitude of reasons for you to leave the country. Ladies and gentlemen, how many more do you need? So, there it is. Absolute insanity rules the new car sales market. Just listen to this. The average loan term for new cars is now 67 months, a record. The average loan term for used cars is now 62 months, a record. Loans with terms from 74 to 84 months made up 30% of all new vehicle financing, a record. Loans with terms, the average amount financed for a new vehicle was $28,711, a record. The average payment for new vehicles was $488, a record. The percentage of all new vehicles financed accounted for by leases was 31.46%, a record. What's happening in the auto loan market reminds me of what happened in the mortgage-backed securities in the run-up to the housing crisis. This is an exact replay of that scenario. Subprime loans make up 40% of the auto loan market. Subprime loans are made to people with poor credit history or no credit history at all. Remember? Of course, the bigger question for the US economy is this. What happens when this bubble bursts, just as auto inventories hit their highest levels relative to sales since 2009? Well, there's our show for the day. Let me just conclude with a little ditty, which I thought might be of some Christmas relevance to you all, ladies and gentlemen. 'Twas the hike before Christmas, and all over the shop, short-end traders were waiting for prices to drop. Bloomberg and Reuters, the FT, all there to capture the moment, if Yellen would dare. Stockbrokers slept fitfully, dreaming of when Fed policy meant lower rates. Thank you, Ben. The hedges, meanwhile, parted on in their yachts, with barely a thought of ascending Fed dots. Commodities managers searched in despair for solace in cupboards, but cupboards were bare. Brick managers looked at each other in shock, with a new acronym for EM markets, COC. The dollar was rallying higher and higher for frontier debt markets, a funeral pyre. There were sellers of iron ore, zinc, copper, and gold. What was mined or extracted got ruthlessly sold. The cameras all turned to report news from Janet, the Fed chief who lived on a different planet. Information received since we met in October. But by now there was nobody left who was sober. So when she announced her first quarter point hike, since nobody heard her, all markets did spike. The Nasdaq went higher, the S&P too. The bond market loved it, and treasuries flew. The Far East went mental, and over in China, the rally in mid-caps could not have been finer. At which point a figure in red fled the room, concerned that he'd caused an untenable boom. The Santa Claus rally was with us all right. Happy Christmas to all, and to all a good night. Well, this is Richard Martin wishing you all a wonderful Christmas, and yes, there will be a show on next week. So until then, bye-bye for now. See you soon.
And there you have it. You decide.